Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today I have an exciting interview with Rhonda Stevenson. She is the president of the Tau Zero Foundation. Tau Zero Foundation is working on interstellar flight, and they're taking it seriously. They have just got a grant from NASA, and they get a lot of money from very wealthy people, really working on trying to colonize different planets. They also talk about they're willing to go to areas that others in their industry are uncomfortable talking about. And it's something that you need to do and look at science objectively so that we can really get past these hard hurdles that we need to get past to really explore space and to create colonies in different areas. So I'm excited to have her here, and let's get into our interview now with Rhonda Stevenson. Hi, Rhonda. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, excellent that you joined. I know that what you represent is so interesting to so many people. So we have a lot of questions, and hopefully you'll be able to answer most of them. Let's start with your foundation's tagline. Your foundation's tagline says pioneering interstellar flight. What does that mean?
Well, there's pioneers in any new endeavor, and we're seeking to pioneer the science and technology that goes into the breakthrough propulsion in physics necessary to make interstellar travel possible.
So where do you feel that you are with that? Are you getting close?
I'm really excited because we're at a time right now where we've been able to effectively demonstrate that we can participate in the short term cislunar budding marketplace, as well as being able to make long-term contributions to, a future that a lot of folks would agree is a little farther off. But by working on developing those necessary technologies now, we are able to promote and participate in the developing space economy as it sits today. And that's very exciting and very rewarding.
Well, your phrase on your website, another phrase that you have is our experts are engaged for the drive to explore ideas beyond the comfort zone of our peers and the competence and objectivity to make genuine, reliable progress. What does that mean? There's a lot in there.
We want to be effective. Everything that we approach in our studies is with rigor, determination, and grit. Having said that, sometimes folks come up with a concept. They want to go in a particular direction, researching what could be possible using the physics that we know today. And sometimes you have to step out a little bit outside of your comfort zone and able to do that effectively and be open-minded and impartial.
But which we don't get to see a lot in science, do we? It becomes almost a religion.
I would say that if we had to cite any faith when it comes to this approach, it would be scientific rigor.
Have you taken any time and looked at the electric universe theories? Because that is, it's way out of most scientists' comfort zones, way out there. But it is proving out in a lot of labs. And I think that some of that science would make a big difference on where we go in flight.
I think the advancement of all physics is very, very important. It's the tools that we use to build those skill sets. Having said that, there's a lot of threads to that. But again, in the interest of being impartial, we are looking at several different ways to approach the same problem.
Okay, well, that's good. Being open-minded and trying to look at all those things. What has propelled you personally to focus your energies on this? Because in life it's really cool to do something that's meaningful, and I shouldn't break your thunder, but why are you doing it?
I was born with a space bug. It's always been a part of my makeup, always a part of my interests and my nature. I was a pretty geeky kid. And
geeky's cool. I'm okay with geeky.
Even though there were times where I had drifted off the beaten path a little bit towards the direction that I had set out for myself. In my adult life, I made a transitional choice to leave one industry and get into the space industry. And I was fortunate enough to do that several years ago. And it has been a successful transition. And I'm grateful. Every day is like Christmas.
Well, working with so many cool things. So why do you think it's so important that we get past Earth? And I know this is a loaded question. There's a lot to this.
There is a lot to do. And it can be at times a loaded question. Science and discovery have driven the human race for all time. I mean, we are explorers inherently. Pioneering is not a new concept. This is the continuation of that drive. Beyond that, we have finite resources, and that is going to become a concern. And as the population increases, it becomes a larger concern. It is our hope that in a single lifetime, we can achieve a viable solution to colonize, to migrate, to expand, so that mankind can become a permanent spacefaring civilization.
Do you see that as possible in our lifetime? Are we close enough? And I know that SpaceX talks about it, and people are talking about colonizing Mars. Where do you see that as realistically in the next couple decades?
I find that to be absolutely realistic. There are a couple of different rationales that you can use with that. But when I was a kid and I had the space bug, but I really wasn't sure what that looked like. The NASA representative came to our school and did his talk. I was in second grade, pulled out that space shuttle tile and his blowtorch and said we could do this. And at that time, his talk was with the expectation that by the time we had graduated high school, we would be colonizing Mars. That was the belief back then. We had that capability back then. We simply changed our priorities. So with the technology that we have today, with the abilities that we have today, we can focus our efforts to building a new home and improving the one that we live on.
So what would that look like? Are you thinking, I mean, like, how long do you think it would take to get there? Would you have to give up all your earthly life? I mean, what would it look like to colonize another planet?
I think that the biggest limiting factor for the longest time for the private person was launch costs. Thankfully, that is not as much of a concern as it was a couple of years ago. Having said that, what do you absolutely need to bring? You need to bring food, water, sustenance. You need to have some care packages sent ahead of you. How much can you transport from one planet to another, taking into account what is and is not possible today, and what are the logistics in making that happen? I think that it's been said by many people that some folks would say, that the first folks who do go to Mars with the intent to live will be going there with a sense of permanence. Whether by choice or not, I hope that that does not become an issue. But what I do feel is important is that we do it, that we do make those steps, and we do forage into that new horizon and colonize Mars.
Do you see it kind of like colonizing the new world kind of thing? I know there are people here and there's a whole bunch of stuff around that, but colonizing, you know, America and then it took a long time by ship. And then now it takes, you know, 8 hours by plane and maybe faster if you go on this supersonic jet thing. Do you eventually see it? Well, we're just going back and forth to Mars as a vacation destination that might just take a day.
I think that those are very real possibilities, and I know that many folks, including ourselves, are working on those solutions for it to be a everyday commonplace thing. But for a while, I don't think that there will be anything that's commonplace about going back to the moon or going to Mars with the intent to stay. I do believe that it's realistic if we approach this defiantly and repeatedly, that within the scope of 30 years, it is realistic that we can have functioning, thriving populations on other worlds, whether that's Mars, the Moon, other destinations that we've discussed. I just think that it's really important that we do this, that we try, that we push forth and continue on.
What other destinations besides the Moon and Mars might be a good place to go?
That's a little outside of the discussions that I have on a daily basis, but from the talks that I've been involved in, the moons of Jupiter, Titan is of certain interest. Other places in our solar system where we can find some heat and some stability. And then beyond that, every day, including today, there are announcements that we are identifying potentially habitable worlds in the rocky zones around other stars. And I think there is a calling in all of us to get there.
So what do we need? I mean, what do you, just something where you can get heat, and then you're going to have to create a whole ecosystem for sustaining life? Or do you kind of see that we create a whole bubble there that makes it work?
I think that there would be too many factors to just list off a grocery list to address those concerns. But naturally, we will need atmosphere, and we will need some form of gravity, and we will need something to clean our air and recycle it and replenish it. We'll need to be self-sufficient. We will need to grow our food, whether that's through animal husbandry or we suddenly become vegetarians. Those are the basics. Beyond that, it would just depend on each circumstance. How hot is too hot? There are places in the solar system here where night is very, very, very cold, and in the sun it's unbearably hot and not survivable. Those are some factors that, of course, we'd have to take into consideration.
So what do you... Okay, I'm going to get into another topic that I'm hoping you can talk about. Many prominent people have claimed to see ETs, you know, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, both publicly admitted witnessing an extraterrestrial thing of some sort. Also recently, Robert Bigelow of the Bigelow Aerospace discussed it on 60 Minutes, which was kind of a big deal. Even countries such as France, Mexico, and Russia have publicly discussed the phenomena, and they don't shy away from it like the United States does or NASA does. Based on all this, what are your views on the phenomena? I mean, how should world governments deal with it? And how does this affect your foundation?
Firstly, it does not affect our foundation. Again, going back to our premise that we are coming from a place of scientific discovery and rigor, there has not been anything that we have encountered that leads us to believe that there is an alien presence. That does not discount the possibility completely, but we don't have a position favoring the possibility or denying it. We simply haven't experienced, encountered, or discovered any science that verifies it. My personal thoughts on that are I absolutely believe that we'll find that the universe is teeming with life. And I don't think that it will be all that surprising to find that it's in many forms rather close outside of our planet. Beyond that, I have not seen anything. I have not had any personal experiences that would lead me to believe that we are encountering visits. Beyond that, we push forth in our bid to discover new worlds, and I imagine that inevitably the time will come that we do encounter other species that need to be recognized and addressed. But in this day and age, and in this time, there's nothing that we can verify or even, you know, joke about behind closed doors that it's a possibility. We just haven't seen the science.
Okay. You have a really amazing group involved with your endeavor. What is the makeup of your group?
They are philosophers, artists, writers, scientists, inventors. We are exceptionally lucky and fortunate to have the collective group that we have. Paul Gilster, as an author, and his work with Centauri Dreams reaches so many people and appeals to folks who are interested in things beyond the solar system and the physics and the science that is involved. We have our board chairman, Jeff Greeson, who is a serial inventor, and he's been a fantastic leader for our foundation. We are so excited to have him. Our chief strategist is Angie Aldrin, and he is helping us continue on in a very specific direction to have these things come to pass. Rod Pyle, the author, is fantastic in helping us keep our cultural connections realistic and relatable, as it stands with the folks who aren't directly involved in those types of studies. There's another gentleman, Bill Toski, who is our executive director, and he does a lot of the orchestrating to the date in the day-to-day activities. We have several subject matter experts, and the list continues to grow. And beyond that, there are so many folks that we're partnered with and other interstellar organizations that we have very strong friendships with and based on very solid foundations. And the two most prominent at this time are the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop, which is having their symposium in October, and we're very much looking forward to that. And Icarus Interstellar. But there are other supporters as well. We've recently entered into an MOU with United Launch Alliance and some other companies of that ilk. So the whole community is coming together in support of these larger concepts of how to get there faster, how to go farther, and now how can we do it in a single lifetime? What are the steps that we need to take to have that come to pass? How do we step out of our comfort zone to make those things come to pass? And I also think that Dr. Aldrin had made a very interesting observation in one of our board meetings. He had said that normally, when he goes with his dad to meetings, he's used to his dad being the most fringe person in the room, and we all laughed because of that agenda of get your ass to Mars. Having been aware of that, Dr. Aldrin had said basically he was in a room with some high-level folks looking to invest into space activities. And he had said that because of the discoveries of planets in the rocky and habitable, potentially habitable zones around other stars, all of a sudden, that talk about getting to Mars was not fringe. It was not impossible. In fact, it was almost uninteresting because everyone in that room at the time was more focused or more interested in how do we get to another planet? How do we get to another star? How can we achieve that in a single lifetime or sooner? And how can we find the economic resources to ensure that that does indeed happen?
Is there a lot of support for it? Are you seeing more and more support for it? Like, is the government working with you? Is NASA working with you? Other companies like SpaceX and Bigelow Aerospace, those kinds of people?
NASA is absolutely supporting us. And a specific thank you to them, as we have been awarded a NASA grant to specifically review what are the interstellar capabilities and possibilities at this time in an impartial and objective manner. So, yes, absolutely, NASA is interested. Beyond that, I think that a lot of folks get excited about the idea that we are identifying habitable places out there. We all realize that the distance is a bit daunting. It could kill your motivation a little bit, but at the same time, I also am finding that there is this sense of inevitability, whereas before it was a 20 to 30 year off in the future musing type of discussion. Now it's being taken seriously. Now there are many, many organizations out there and businesses and scientists looking to discover ways that we can get there faster and ways to be sustainable when we do it, and what the human factors are and what the consequences could be. I do believe that in the last, I'd say 2 years, that whole movement has become more mainstream and as I said, accepted as an inevitability.
You talk about fringe. What is fringe? What is the edge of what scientists are starting to talk about and willing to talk about?
I think that a lot of times, and this is just an opinion, that when you talk about fringe, it means to imply the unknown. But oftentimes it is also thought to be absurd. We're not interested in the absurdities. We are interested in the possibilities. Taking a second and third and fourth look at some of our scientific approaches can be used as a model or a compass on which direction we should go and which ones to avoid. But I don't think that there's a lot of conversation about what is fringe. You know, we can laugh and joke about some of the stereotypes. That wouldn't be appropriate for this conversation. Having said that, though, at this time, with the things that that we're looking into being led by Jeff Greeson and others, there really isn't anything that is necessarily fringe anymore. There are no impossibilities with the way that we're taking our approach.
As long as you see some kind of validity to it or see some science, you'll look at it and you'll dive in and try to take it seriously, because otherwise it's going to hold you back, right? What you're trying to get accomplished if you won't take an open mind at different things.
I think that's absolutely true, but that also comes with the decision and the quality of being disruptive. As we all know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting, you know, a different result. And in being disruptive and in instigating different practices or different approaches, that is one way that scientists are approaching these issues and these problems that we all feel are solvable. It's just a matter of how and when and as always, inevitably, these discussions on how to start with the small projects that build into larger projects, that build into missions, it all comes back to funding. Everything about the initiation of these activities are solely dependent in a lot of ways on funding. Now, that does not mean that at some point when you do get the funding and you are in the pursuit of scientific discovery, that you don't find some scientific and mathematical roadblocks. Those absolutely do exist. But in practice and in methodically continuing to push forth, I would say that inevitably it becomes a financial issue rather than a what is possible issue.
What are you doing to try to get past some of those financial hurdles? Are you looking for government money? Are you looking for private money? I mean, how is that gonna, I'm sure you're always trying to figure this out, like everybody trying, but what are you currently trying to do?
We are always, always looking for additional funding. There is an unlimited amount of science and discovery that we would like to put our hands to. We are limited financially, but again, that's universal across the board with most of the space community organizations. Having said, we're a 501c3. We're a nonprofit for science that is not an educational institution. So it gives us a few more opportunities that perhaps might not otherwise be available. it still stands that our number one funding platform is philanthropy. There are SBIRs and NASA grants and other types of grants that we are absolutely pursuing. And some of those are new. We are engaged in some projects where we are soliciting the Department of Energy, and we're very excited about that. But government support, philanthropy, all those, you know, types of things are our limiting factor. And I think that most organizations will tell you that there's always more projects when the funding for a particular source tends to either lose interest or you know, they run dry on their investment.
Are they looking for something for you to provide? Like when NASA gives you a grant or somebody gives you a grant, are you trying to get to a point so that they'll give you more money? Like, are they looking for you to discover something or come, you know, clear some ways that they can use as well?
I'm really glad that you asked that question. That's actually two questions, and if you don't mind, I'd like to break that down. There are grants and funding announcements, funding opportunities, where whether it's a general call or a specific solution that some organization or government entity is looking to solve. And those are finite. Those are defined, funded, and available if whatever it is that you suggest you have the solution for is of interest enough to them, or they feel that you can meet the technological and scientific requirements to produce results. That is one form of funding, and something that I think 98% of the population that's in the space community is familiar with. When it comes to more government funding and increase in available funds from the government or from philanthropists or from private groups who are looking to invest in the developing space industry, they're all looking for the same thing. And this is a hurdle that is going to continue to be there until consumers have enough faith in scientific discovery and the progress that we are making into the space realm as an economy shifts. And what that is they're looking for a return on investment. In general, those return on investments are 3 to 5 years. That's a normal realistic expectation for most terrestrial projects. With the way that the cislunar orbital and planetary studies are geared and the way that they need to develop and the way that we need to produce the mechanisms to achieve those goals, that ROI is pushed back anywhere from, I feel comfortable saying, between 5 to 11 years. And so a general investor who's really excited about space is told that they're going to have to wait for the return on their investment for a minimum of 5 to 7 years. Well, they start looking back at those 3 to 5 year investments that they can make that are generally a pretty sure thing, and it's harder for them to risk that level of funding. But that is precisely the level of funding that the space community needs to get over that hump, because once we do, then that industry will blossom in a way that the 3 to 5 year ROI is absolutely realistic and achievable. But we have to implement the infrastructure first.
We have to get past the 3 to 5 and look at the 5 to 7.
Or longer, potentially. Yeah. Depends on what the goals are. But 3 to 5, the only place that is a very viable, rational conversation are missions that are already planned and in the orbital realm from LEO to GEO.
So why haven't we gone back to the moon or done... You know, we went to the moon once, and then it seemed like NASA just kind of really got pulled in. You know, like we're not doing much since then. Is it funding? I mean, what is going on?
The response is a little bit rote. But to that, I would say that the Apollo program was enormously expensive. exhaustively expensive. And once we demonstrated that we could do it, we could get there, and we could get there first, and then we could get there repeatedly, funding allocations began to decline. And I really honestly believe that the only obstacle was financial.
Really? Because when you look at how much we spend on military, which is absolutely enormous, why would we, I mean, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like that much compared to what we're spending on so many other things right now.
That's a consideration for human nature. An acquaintance of mine gives a talk, and in that they say that human beings will fund fear by an exponential degree of 10 to the 10th level to protect themselves from things that they are fearful of, more so than they fund discovery and research and curiosity. That has been a limiting factor. We've been to the moon. There's not an industry at this time, that's not to say that can't happen in the next 6 months, but there's not a commercial industry right now providing that 3 to 5 year ROI that kept us going back to the moon.
Well, asteroids and things, there's a lot of mining possibilities, right?
There are absolutely a lot of mining possibilities. One theory is that if you want to get to Mars, you have to find a secure source of water, either from the moon or from a near Earth body, and use that water to get to your next destination as fuel. The gravity well is very expensive, and transporting fuel, transporting anything that would be considered energy off planet is still very, very expensive. The argument is that if we were to exploit a water source off planet, then trips to the other planets, to Mars, to the Lagrange points, those types of I hesitate to call them missions, but those types of endeavors are a lot more achievable financially and conceivably faster if we had access to water off planet.
So energy is always a problem. What about some of these new energy, like alternative energies, like University of Colorado came up with this way to tap into the zero point energy, and MIT has been doing some of that. Are you looking at some of those things that they've been looking into where it's different? You know, it's not fuel based. It's tapping into, you know, more, you know, at the zero point where they, that with Colorado, what they did and they patented it is they realized that the electron is going around, you know, the atom level going around, and it's something keeps it going, because everything in the basics physics is things slow down to entropy, right? So if it doesn't slow down, then the law of physics is wrong. If it does slow down, then we wouldn't have matter. So they theorize that something is causing it to pick up energy again. So they forced it to slow down, and sure enough, it got zapped with energy. And so they came up with this idea to put it through this, you know, little mechanism that slows down the electrons and zap the energy and pull that, and it keeps going. And that's what they did at the University of Colorado. So there's so much potential there. Have you looked into some of those things?
We absolutely do have folks on our team who are looking into the theories for zero point energy. I would say, and I can say this easily, that energy is one of the most important factors to address when it comes to any type of off-planet mission, whether that's an orbital project or to the moon, to Mars, or beyond. And it's not just the energy, it's the energy storage. How can we viably, consistently, and safely contain enough energy that will sustain us for long-term trips, unforeseen events, mm-hmm. And basically carrying it like a package to another place where we intend to stay, and then implement an additional energy source. So in a lot of ways, energy is a determining factor on the success of a lot of missions.
So what are you doing now? What are some of the most exciting things that you guys are doing?
Well, in the interest of remaining impartial, I can't discuss in depth too many of the things that we're looking into at this time and some of the things that we're actually working on.
Is it top secret? Is it not? Or you just don't want to? Why not?
Projects come in phases. And when you are in the beginning phases, you tend to be a bit conservative until you receive your funding and the edification that you are on a discernible path to success.
Okay. You don't want to set yourself up to look like fools or say you're doing something where you don't get the funding or something like that.
Well, it's not necessarily that. It's that, because of the role that the Tau Zero Foundation has stepped up to take, we must remain impartial with the things that we discuss. We do have interest within our organization that we are cultivating, and we do have projects that we are actually in the process of executing right now. And one of those that I can discuss is we are looking for an energy source.
Hold on a second. Can you repeat that?
Sure. We are exploring an energy storage solution. We do have our phase one project in action, and we do hope that this method, this way of containing energy densely and safely could be the answer to some energy storage solutions.
Well, how do you see that as affecting industry? I mean, when you come up with something, it could really help a lot of other areas.
Energy storage is, I think, one of the single most important industrial concerns, either terrestrially or anything off planet. In order to have successful missions in space, at some point we need some form of energy, whether that's to go to the moon or to Mars and we need propellant, or to run our systems while we're up there. It's often discussed about, larger space stations and habitats and the sustainability of those habitats. And those are wonderful, necessary things, but what will power them? How will we store our energy? How will we make sure that that's safe? In space, it's crucial because it's a component financially. Terrestrially, bringing energy solutions to our planet globally, it's obvious we're going to be able to improve the quality of life for so many. Our impact and our footprint will become significantly less. And then hopefully, too, it will free up a lot of money spent on energy for other things like exploration and pioneering.
Okay, so what other interesting thing are you working on? You got to give us something. Because this is the coolest stuff going on. So what are you doing?
Another project that I can't get into the details too much of, but it's energy related in that the problem or the question to be asked is, how do we get from here to there faster? And if we were able to get a jump start on our mission to going faster, are there things that we could capture from our environment to escalate our speeds to get there even faster? And what does that look like? But then again, that becomes a concern of physics, because once you get going and you're on your way, that's great. But eventually you're going to have to slow down. You're going to have to stop, most likely turn, land, change course. So those are a lot of factors of, it's great to get going very fast in a straight line, but then how do we change that? And that's one of the things that we're working on right now.
Yeah, I suppose it's not just going fast, but now you got to stop.
How do you stop? Right. And then did you take enough energy with you, or is there enough energy in your environment available so that you can do those things. I mean, if you get out there, great, but can you get back home? And that's why many of the initial missions will be robotic, will be probes, for that very reason.
So how long will it take us now to get to Mars based on our what we think we have?
Depending on the orbital cycles between the Earth and Mars, I believe the absolute shortest time possible at this time is 9 months. And I believe the longer duration, I can't remember the exact figures on that, but I believe it was 2.8 years at the farthest point.
Well, I mean, you think about it, it took us, what, 3 months by ship to go from England to the United States. So it's getting down there.
It is getting down there. Again, it's a question of sustainability. If we're very excited, we will have no less than 4 human spaceflight programs in the next 4 to 7 years. We are pushing forth, and we are going to go there, and we are going to do these things. But part of the considerations of the human factors is, what are they going to eat? How are they going to breathe air? And how do you keep someone occupied that's on a minimum of a let's just say 4 year round trip to there and back again safely?
Well, if it's 9 months, I'm going out the most optimistic. 18 months back and forth, you could stay there for a couple years. It'd be like how long it takes to go to college. It's not that bad, right? I mean, we're starting to get in the, I mean, when you think about the trips that people used to take to England or America in the early days, they would plan a good year out of their life. So it's not, we're starting to approach that.
Absolutely, we are starting to approach that. And I think that that's one of the reasons why these farther missions as concepts are beginning to become taken more seriously and entering into the realm of fundability. We're ready as a civilization with that pioneering mindset and the need for discovery, the things that drive us. I think that in general, folks are accepting that this at some point will become an inevitability. To expedite that, however, again, the folks who go first will be the pioneers. They will be the risk takers and the adventurers and the folks who make an enormous sacrifice for the greater good so that these things can come to pass and do that in a way that it becomes just part of our lifestyle, part of our awareness of that's just what you do.
Do you imagine young people going there and planning to have families and stuff?
Absolutely.
Soon? I mean, do you think that would be part of the first people going there? Or do you think it's more like scientists and people that are going to go figure things out and send information back? I suppose that has to be first. But when do you think it'll be that couples, young couples will go and have families and, you know, build a life?
I don't think that it'll be all that long. I think that there'll be kind of the first or preliminary missions will probably look, you know, very, very rehearsed, very controlled, very predictable. But in that, I would say, in just even in the beginning phase, the folks who go second and third, the boots on Mars as an activity of regularity, life will happen. And life will occur and continue to exist. Many of those folks who go will be going with the understanding and the plan that they won't be coming back. And that's the commitment they make, just as folks made that commitment 300 and 400 years ago. I believe that we're rapidly approaching that point again. I don't believe, and this is just my opinion, that there'll be a long span of time between the first folks who get to Mars and put their stake in the ground and the first child born on Mars. And I hope to see those two things happen, you know, very soon and with regularity.
What do we need to do to be able to breathe the air on Mars? Are you seeing us changing the atmosphere, or are we going to have an apparatus that people are going to have to wear?
I imagine, and I'm not an expert on Mars or the infrastructure of colonization. However, the number one concern is going to be protection from radiation and a recyclable atmosphere. I've read, I've seen, I've spoken with some of my peers that the plan is to have enclosed systems, perhaps underground, perhaps lava tubes, something that provides the protection from radiation, and then also to be able to recycle atmosphere and produce your own atmosphere. That's pretty much what the first phase will look like. Additional structures, the act of building the infrastructure to live on Mars comfortably and consistently, those constructs will grow from what was successful, whether it be underground or reinforced paneling for that radiation protection. Ultimately, can we change the atmosphere as it is on Mars? That's a very speculative conversation, and one that I may not be qualified to have. But again, in my opinion, if you are to take the issues of climate change and you are to look at our population and the impact that we've had on our world inadvertently over the last 100 years, and the impact that scientists say, you know, you can put on a chart, you can demonstrate, you know, we have impacted the planet. All things being equal, if we were to do that deliberately on Mars with focus and deliberation, what could we do, as the planet is significantly smaller? Is that a possibility? That may be something that someone takes on. I don't believe that that's going to be something that's going to be a near-term discussion, but it's possible.
Well, in other areas, you know, other rock, you know, that you're finding other habitable planets, maybe they might be easier atmospheres to change. Or is it even possible to find, you know, I suppose anything's possible, but are you thinking that maybe there is a planet out there or a body out there, a moon, that has an atmosphere already that's close to ours?
We don't have a clear idea of what we're going to find. However, we have been able to identify atmospheres on exoplanets, and that was very, very exciting. We're getting better at being able to say definitively whether there's water content in the atmosphere of those planets, and we will get closer to that particular question in the very near term. Having said that, I don't believe that it's necessarily random. The elements of our makeup are the elements of our makeup. I believe that it's absolutely possible to find another planet just like Earth. It's absolutely possible to find an atmosphere similar to ours. Maybe it has gravity, maybe it's warm enough, but and maybe there's not enough nitrogen in that atmosphere, or too much oxygen, or too much carbon dioxide. There are so many variables, it's difficult to predict. But ultimately, do I feel that it's realistic to find something that's close enough? Absolutely, I do.
That's really exciting. It'll be really fun to see how this develops and to see where you guys go. There are people working on anti-aging technology that's coming. And I think our ability to live a lot longer will compound our problems on Earth, but it'll also give us time for scientists who are close to discoveries. They'll get more time to figure things out. And it'll be amazing the compounded abilities that we'll have when we can live longer, you know, even if it's just a couple decades.
Absolutely. I agree. We do want more life, and we want, all of us want more time. We fight for that. But at the same time, the more time that we have, the greater our impact, the greater the population density increases. So there are problems that come with, you know, our population only growing and not decreasing in any way. Will we use that ability to spend more time in science and discovery? Well, I certainly hope so. I believe that we would be driven to do that. And we're doing it now.
Well, I think with these anti-aging technologies realistically on the horizon, I have a feeling your mission will become that much more critical. It's just the timing of it, and it's something that we really need to seriously look at. Because if aging, I mean, you just can't, I don't know how we're going to deal with the population issues and some of these other issues without, you know, working on what you're working on.
I absolutely agree with you. I believe that moving into space, developing our space environment, and colonization are obvious solutions for a problem that's going to escalate rapidly, logarithmically.
Yeah, very quickly. Yeah. It will be like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Right.
Yeah.
How do you find clean water for 10 billion people?
Exactly. Suddenly we really got some serious issues, and it could get ugly too. I mean, your brain can go kind of crazy thinking about some of those things. Okay. So how can people learn more about you, your work, the Tau Zero Foundation? Where do they go?
The Tau Zero Foundation's website is at tauzero.aero. As I said, we are also co-hosting an event in October called the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop Symposium, and that's being held in Huntsville, Tennessee. And it's a welcoming, warm workshop to address a lot of the topics that we've covered today. We also have quite a following through social media. We have our fan pages on Facebook, and we're also on LinkedIn. We continue to do outreach projects. We've recently integrated a program where we help women and non-traditional students return to school.
Oh, excellent.
We want to help and promote folks that want to contribute into the labor force that will become necessary, and we want to implement what that infrastructure could look like. We want to participate in that. So that's one of our outreach programs. We have another outreach program that we are in the process of putting together to participate with World Space Week during the same week as our symposium, to help promote space science globally, and that interest and that engagement from kindergarten on up. And we'll be announcing what that looks like very soon. And then we're also starting some pilot clubs in elementary schools so that we do have greater reach, and we can participate in that whole education curve necessary so that that we can all achieve that goal collectively as a civilization.
Oh, that's so great. Thank you so much for joining us, and I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I really appreciate being here.